From News Talk 580 1059 KMJ, this is the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition. Now here's your host, Mark Kepler.
There have been some big changes in California's criminal justice system in the last several years. Having more nonviolent, non-serious offenders spend time in county jails as opposed to state prison. Amending the three strikes law to require that that third strike be for serious or violent offenses. Reducing certain drug offenses to misdemeanors. And more recently, criminal sentencing reform to allow earlier parole for good behavior. And while crime rates are at historic lows, they're beginning to inch up. Is this the beginning of a long-term trend or just a short-term aberration? We'll ask two experts on criminal justice with the Nonpartisan Public Policy Institute of California, Magnus Lofstrom and Brandon Martin. Recent crime trends. Should we feel safe or sorry?
We'll also hear from Jerry Dyer, Chief of Police for the City of Fresno, Kings County District Attorney Keith Fagundes, Madera County Sheriff Jay Varney, and California State University Fresno Criminology Professor Emma Hughes.
Additional funding for the Matty Report made possible by a grant from The Wonderful Company, harvesting health and happiness around the world. From the California Channel at the State Capitol and the Matty Institute, it's the Matty Report with Executive Director of the Matty Institute, Mark Kepler.
Welcome. Criminal justice, keeping people safe, may be the most basic function of government. How is California doing when it comes to crime and punishment? Our guests are two experts in criminal justice, Magnus Lofstrom and Brandon Martin, both with the Nonpartisan Public Policy Institute of California. Welcome.
Thanks, Mark.
So, Magnus, let me start with you first. There's a sense that crime rates are increasing as a result of realignment, maybe in Prop 47. Obviously, people are worried about violent crime in particular. What are the trends on violent crime recently?
Well, I agree with you that it's violent crime is what people are particularly concerned about when we implement these new reforms and significant changes to criminal justice system here in California. We have seen, when it comes to violent crimes, we've been on a long-term decline going back till the early 1990s. In more recent years, we saw an uptick in 2012, but they start to come back down in 2013, 2014. But we are seeing an uptick in 2015 of about 8.4% in the violent crime rate.
I was looking at your reports, and it's interesting. You know, we were up to as high as 1,104 violent crimes per 100,000 in 92, pretty high. Just to put it in context, we're at 366 now, so about a third of that.
The most recent year that we have data for, which is 2015, mm-hmm. we were at 426
okay, so it's
per 100,000.
So it's bumped up a little bit, but still from an historical perspective.
It's very low. It is, not only is it low in a historic context, it's about the rates, the levels that we saw in the late 1960s. Mm-hmm. But we put a lot of emphasis on the reforms that we've implemented in the last 5 years. So one useful way to compare where we are today is to just look where were we right before realignment was rolled out in 2011, the mm-hmm. first of these significant reforms. And we are slightly below those violent crime rates.
Okay. Brandon, I want to ask you about violent crime rates and whether they are isolated to particular counties or particular parts of the state.
Sure. So when we look at the increase from 2014 to 2015, or look between those years, it's not isolated. So 40 counties out of the state's 58 saw an increase in their violent crime rates between 2014 and 2015. Of those 40 counties, 21 actually saw an increase of more than 10%.
That's a jump, 10%.
Yes.
Okay, so it's not isolated to one particular area or another. It seems to be pretty universal.
Yeah, large counties, small counties, yeah. All across all the regions of the state.
Well, Max, let me switch gears a little bit here and talk about property crimes. Some law enforcement officials are expressing the belief that Prop 47 has resulted in more property crime. How does property crime today compare to what it was prior to 47, Prop 47?
Well, they did come up in 2015 as well. They came up by about 6.6%, the property crime rate. But again, we are on this long-term decline that goes back, when it comes to property crime, it goes back to 1980. There have been a few years when it's come up temporarily. 2012, the year after realignment, is one example, and 2015 is another example. 2014, we actually hit a 50-year low.
50-year low?
50-year low in 2014, right before Prop 47 was passed.
No, your reports are fantastic. They give a lot of data. And one thing I noticed in there you were talking about was 6,900 per 100,000 property crimes in 1980. And just to put it into comparison, about 2,600 today. So again, big decrease. People might be feeling it and maybe
isolated instance, they read it in the newspaper, but if you look at overall the crime statistics, property crime is way down. Brendan, let me ask you this. What impact does geography have on crime rates generally? I mean, does it depend, we're talking whether violent or property crimes, does it depend on your zip code?
Sure. Whether you look at zip code, city, county, even region, we see wide differences in crime rates across the state. And so in this report, we only look at county and region, but taking, you know, violent and property crime, the lowest rates of those occur in the small rural counties of the Sierras and in the South Coast, so Ventura, Orange, San Diego County, where the highest crime rates in terms of violent and property in the state occur in the San Joaquin Valley. And the San Joaquin Valley rates are about double for both violent and property compared to the lowest region rate across the state.
Is that poverty driving that?
Well, there's a number of factors. So it could be poverty. It could be the number of law enforcement staffing. It could be larger economic issues. It could be even, you know, county sort of political choices.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you for explaining these recent crime trends in California. Up next, we're going to talk about policing and what that means for lower crime rates. A look at the challenges of police staffing in a moment. This is the Matty Report. Welcome back. We're talking about criminal justice with two experts from the nonpartisan PPIC, Magnus Lofstrom and Brandon Martin. I want to ask you about, Magnus, about cops on the beat, staffing levels. They seem to have taken a hit during the recession, not surprisingly. Have they recovered?
No, they haven't. We saw increases, pretty steady increases, roughly along the lines of the population growth in California in the early 2000. Great recession hit in 2008, and since then we've seen a drop of about 4,000 officers, sworn officers in California. That's a drop of about 5%. It hasn't recovered. In the last couple of years, it's leveled and come up slightly.
Is it coming up more than the growth in population? Or?
No, it's not. So in fact, if we look at the number of sworn officers that we have per 100,000 residents, and compare that to 2008, it was around 220, 221 per 100,000 mm-hmm. residents. We're now below 200 at 198. So that's a 10% drop. It's not keeping pace with population growth in California.
Okay, Brandon, you know, law enforcement seems to be more of a local issue, you know, more than state government. I assume we're seeing more of an impact now at the local level in terms of these police staffing levels. Isn't ultimately crime a local issue? And so is police enforcement.
Yeah. So both crime and law enforcement are a local issue. And historically, you're correct. Counties and cities have provided the bulk of police protection for their residents. The state does have the California Highway Patrol. That force makes up about 10% of all sworn officers in the state. Their duties are to patrol the state highways and interstates and then also to protect elected officials and buildings. So most of your on-the-beat cops are at the county and city level.
Yeah, I was looking at your statistics and I added them up. Mm-hmm. I think my math is right, 87% of the police staffing is at the county and
yes.
city level. There's
yes.
some other police officers like work for universities and special police officers, but
yep.
about 87%, which is a large number, local level.
Yes.
And you know, we were talking off camera before this segment about, you know, how much of that police costs are in the city or county budgets. And I've seen the numbers be quite high. If you talk about public safety, if you add fire and police and pensions, I mean, you're talking up 70-80% sometimes. So it can be very, very expensive for a community. Max, let me ask you this about some people are saying that maybe you really can't arrest your way out of the crime problem. Others argue that, you know, no, actually you can. If you have more police officers, that's a pretty cost-effective way to prevent crime. What does your research show?
Well, we, a number of years ago, and we've updated this research, we looked first at what is the crime preventive effect of incarceration, one of the other major tools that we use to manage public safety. And we looked at it in the context of realignment, where there was a big drop in the number of offenders who are being incarcerated in California. We estimate about 18,000. And we looked at what happened to crime there, and then can we use that information to tell us how cost-effective is incarceration? We found that if you take and you spend an additional dollar on incarceration in California, we get only about 23 cents back in terms of crime prevention. Now, switch that to the topic here, which is policing. What about if we spend that additional dollar on hiring an additional police officer? Well, the research on that shows a cost preventive savings of $1.62, so a much more cost-effective way to deal with crime prevention. I think there's one other important aspect of this when we talk about it. Adding police to the on the street and the crime preventive effect, it's not an arrest effect per se. Research shows that when you have police presence in the community, it's the deterrence effect. That's the main thing that actually has an impact on,
right.
on
we all know that as we're driving down the highway, if we see a highway patrol, we slow it down a little bit. That would be the anecdotal evidence. Brandon, I want to ask you about police community relations. It's been a lot in the news a lot lately about police profiling, perhaps excessive use of force in some isolated situations. How do Californians feel about community police relations? Are they kind of tracking the national narrative on this?
Yeah, so there has been a lot in the national news about this. PPIC's statewide survey center actually has asked about this in some of our statewide surveys. And so the most recent survey that asked about it was in January of this year, 2016. And what they find is that 61% of Californians surveyed believe that blacks and other minorities do not receive equal treatment in the criminal justice system. And this is actually up about 6 percentage points from the last time they asked in
January. Does that matter what ethnic group you're in?
So across all ethnic groups, a majority feel that way. They hold those views. The lowest, I believe, was in terms of whites was about 55%, and 93% of blacks believe that.
Wow, that is a tremendous, if you look at African-Americans and blacks, 92-93%, those are high numbers.
Yes, yeah.
Well, up next, we're going to take a look at the county jail situation in California in light of realignment and those other issues. That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome back. We're talking with Magnus Lofstrom and Brandon Martin about crime in California. They're experts with the Nonpartisan Public Policy Institute of California. So, Brandon, I want to ask you about county jails. Mm-hmm. After someone's arrested, that's typically where they end up, at a county jail. Can you give us some quick data on county jail facilities? And are they short-hold or long-hold facilities? How old are they? Who's in there?
Sure. So the majority of county jails in the state are long-hold facilities. There are some city jails and county substations that will hold inmates for 2 to 3 days until they can be transferred to the long-hold facility to be booked.
Is it historically, though, haven't county jails been short-hold facilities?
Yes. In terms of sentenced individuals, mm-hmm. county jails historically never held someone on more than a year sentence. Now they can hold anyone for as long as the sentence right. may be
it's
realignment.
It's changed after realignment.
Yes.
But that means the facilities were designed for short hold and now they're holding long hold.
Yes.
How old are these facilities?
Exactly. So of the roughly 125 county facilities across the state, over half of them were built before 1990, and even some of them were built before the 1960s. And so there is an aging jail issue in the state.
What do the inmates look like in the
yeah,
county
jail? Yeah, so most inmates in the state are male. They're being held on a felony charge, mm-hmm. and they are awaiting arraignment, trial, or sentencing. And so they're non-sentenced individuals.
Okay. Max, I want to ask you about, I want to backtrack a little bit here and talk about the policy move from state prison to county jails, the whole realignment issue. How has it impacted county jails?
Well, realignment brought some new challenges to county jails. County jails were, before realignment, operated about 9% of their rated capacity, so the number of beds that they were designed to hold inmates. And with realignment, there were two big changes that put pressure on them. One was, prior to this reform, parole violators were sent back to state prison. You can't do that anymore.
I think they were calling them frequent flyers.
That's right. Yeah. You know, we saw that a lot. That was a big part of the prison population. Right. So that was stemmed with realignment, and they are now locally sanctioned. And some of that sanction might be spending time in county jail. That's one of the challenge. But the other one is alluding back to this change in how long people are now spending time in California county jails. Newly convicted, so-called triple non, these are offenders who are convicted of a non-sexual, non-violent, and non-serious felony and who do not have a criminal history of one of those offenses. Instead of going to state prison, they are now serving their time in county jail. And that means that they are serving sentences well over the 1 year that these facilities were designed for.
So let's talk about some of the long-term issues for county jails, given that shift from state prisons to county jails.
So it increases the need for services, programming, and
you're not just locking up and throwing away the key.
Right. They're going to spend a significant amount of time there. So and one of the significance when we talked about this cutoff in 1990 and almost half of the facilities were are older than that. There's a cutoff in how we built jail as well. We're moving into more of a modular design, space for programming, treatment, recreation, and so forth, that weren't present prior to that. So a number of facilities don't, a number of jails don't have the space to provide the kind of services that are needed for successful reentry.
But more beds are coming online, right? In terms of county jails, they're starting to build capacity?
Funding has been provided to the county jails to build new facilities, and it is an increased emphasis on exactly this, programming services and treatments, as opposed to just adding beds.
And I assume the state's saying, since we're now moving these folks or not having them stay at state prison or staying at county jails, we're going to provide some funding so you can build more,
that's right,
more facilities.
That's right.
Okay. Brandon, I want to ask you about Prop 47, which was approved by the voters in 2014, that reclassified some property and drug crimes from felonies to misdemeanors. Did that help actually reduce the county jail populations?
Yeah, so what we see is after Prop 47 passed in November of 2014, in the first 2 months after that passage, the jail population statewide decreases by about 10,000.
Wow.
And so it's a very significant and quick drop. When we look
at the total amount in county jails, I want to say it was 70,000.
No, it was at that point it was about 83,000.
Okay, close.
Yeah.
I'm not the expert. You are.
Yeah, and so you know, throughout 2015, we don't see the large decrease continuing. It sort of levels off, and as of December 2015, which is the most recent month we have data, it's still down about 10,000, or about 12% of what the jail population was in October 2014.
So we were talking earlier about the age of the county jail facilities, many of them built more than 25 years ago. With the increase in jail populations and the longer holds, what the states should be doing something to help, but then we have, you know, Prop 47. How does that change the calculus?
Sure. So the state is providing about $2.5 billion in new funding for jail construction since 2007. And that will go to add about 14,000 new jail beds. Prop 47 does change the calculus because it brings down the average daily population. But when we look at sort of the change of these long-term inmates after realignment, there's still a need for the programming space, the medical and mental health care space that you need for long-term inmates. And so this $2.5 billion, most of it is going to replace sort of these aging facilities. Mm-hmm. And so we'll have new modular design where you have secure programming, you have secure medical and mental health care, all in sort of the pod, and it will make it easier to hold inmates for a long time.
And it sounds like we have to wait and see what happens with Prop 47 to determine whether or not we need to build new facilities because of the cost and expense, the time involved.
They are costly to build. They take a long time. The facilities that we're building now are smaller because of the cost. And so while we're taking some old facilities offline, we are sort of losing some of that capacity because the new facilities are smaller. And so we sort of just have to see what the long-term sort of trend is with Prop 47.
Okay, we're going to talk about that in a moment. When we come back, this is the Maddie Report. Welcome back. We're talking with Magnus Lofstrom and Brandon Martin from the PPIC about crime in California and the impact of some of these more recent dramatic reforms have had on the system. We see the state prisons population has declined due to realignment. We see Prop 47 reducing population pressures on county jails. The question is, where do we go from here? So Magnus, I want to ask you, what do you think are the most cost-effective solutions to reduce crime in the short term?
When we look at it in the short term, I mean, we have these big reforms, big changes, and I think it is key that we have short-term solutions, medium-term and long-term solutions in addressing this. So if we start with the shorter term, the first one is looking at policing. There is the local response to it. What is the new population that we're dealing with? So local strategies to deal with those challenges, that's part of it.
And staffing is part of it.
And staffing is part of it as well. That is, adding more staff on the streets is one way to deal with these pressures, possible upward pressures on crime trends that the reforms might present. So staffing is one. And then when we look a little bit further down the road, then it's looking at the offender population themselves and ways to reduce reoffending. And there are, you know, a number of ways that we can think about that. And I think it's in the real long term, it's looking further down the road. It's looking at at-risk youth. It is
that's
thinking
the
of
long-term ways. Strategy.
It really is, but it is. What are the things that we can do to prevent at-risk youth from even entering the criminal justice system? So that's looking at schooling policies, truancy, all kinds of strategies to deal with that.
I'm guessing the statistics are probably going to be similar to what you see in education. Like by third grade, you know whether a student is going to graduate from high school. Probably similarly, at a pretty young age, you're going to know whether someone's tracking in the wrong direction in terms of crime, I assume.
Well, I mean, we do know that those go hand in hand, mm-hmm. you know. Dropping out of high school is associated with higher crime participation as well. So there are, you know, there are strategies to deal with that. There's also cognitive behavioral therapy as well, looking at ways to change behavior and preventing people from participating.
Not just the short term, you need to look at the long term. I want to ask you also, though, about recidivism and that revolving door. So you're thinking that, you know, that kind of the focus on education, rehabilitation is a way to stop, get those people off the path of crime.
That's right. I mean, I think ideally what you want to do is you want to have this multiple pronged strategy to deal with this. And part of it is look at the younger population as well. But there is an offender population that is in the criminal justice system. And the question is, what can we do to reduce reoffending among this population? We have implemented a number of changes in California over these last 5 years. Counties are trying various strategies mm-hmm. to deal with the challenges that they've been presented with. And some of these strategies are successful. And the question is, how do we identify those? We need to move towards evidence-based practices, look at the data to figure out what works and in what context does it work and for what offender population.
Yeah, I want to ask Brandon that. You bring up a really good question. That's kind of, you start reading about this stuff, you hear about this enforcement-focused strategy versus a reentry-focused approach. Do either seem to be better? Is the data showing that either is better at approaching recidivism and reducing crime?
Well, with what data there is, some of our colleagues at PPIC have looked at this, and they do find a relationship between the reentry focused and having lower recidivism rates for individuals released from state prison that are then supervised by county probation. Our colleagues are also going beyond that, though, and so they're working with 12 counties across the state to collect very specific individual level data from these counties to look at specific programs that might be effective in reducing recidivism.
You know, Max, I want to end with this. You know, are we looking at the right metric? I was wondering, are we looking at the right measurement? What do we focus on when we're talking about improving the crime and criminal justice in California? Should we be comparing ourselves to national trends, historical trends? How do we know if criminal justice reform is even working?
Well, I think it's coming back to where we started off this program, and that is public safety, crime rates. Let's start by looking at that. We have big reforms, big changes, and we do need to take a close look at, are these changes leading to more crime? Do they have an impact on public safety? That's a key issue to look at. The way we can do that is certainly by looking at how these changes are affecting counties differently to then see if there's a relationship between how they're affected and what we see in terms of public safety. But yes, also look at what goes on in the rest of the country, because there are important lessons. We are not the only ones who are seeing increases in crime rates in 2015. So the question of what Prop 47 has done to crime as of today is an unknown.
I think the key here is data-driven, and that's what the PPIC
right.
is all about. And I want to thank Magnus Lofstrom and Brendan Martin from the nonpartisan PPIC for joining us. If you want to stay up with state and local politics, you can follow the Maddie Institute on Facebook, Twitter, or log on to our website at maddieinstitute.org.
Up next, are things getting more safe or more dangerous in the Valley? We'll ask Madera County Sheriff Jay Varney, Kings County District Attorney Keith Fagundes, Jerry Dyer, City of Fresno's Police Chief, and California State University Fresno Criminology Professor Emma Hughes.
You're listening to the Maddie Report, Valley Views Edition on KMJ.
Welcome back. So are the recent changes in the criminal justice system making the Valley more safe or less safe? We've got a diverse group to answer that question. We have Chief Jerry Dyer with the City of Fresno. Welcome, Chief.
Thank you for having me.
And we got Madera County Sheriff Jay Varney. Welcome, Sheriff Varney.
Thank you, Mark. Glad to be here.
Great. Kings County District Attorney Keith, I knew I was going to have a hard time with this. Fagundes,
that's perfect. Thank you for having me as well.
Thank you. I'll try not to mess it up too badly. And we have Cal State University Fresno Criminology Professor Emma Hughes. Welcome, Professor Hughes.
Hi, happy to be here.
Okay, so we're going to start with Kings County DA Fagundes first here about crime rates. You know, statewide, there seem to be at or near historical lows, but there seems to be some trending upward a little bit. How are they in your community?
Well, in our little small community, we do see an uptick in violent crime. That's actually been on the rise since AB 109 went into effect. We also see
AB 109 is what for our audience?
That was one of the very first efforts to realign the criminal justice system, how we punish people, how we house them.
Okay, instead of going to state prison, they're in county jails.
Correct.
Okay.
And they gave a 3-month lead time to send them back to county jail for the alleged rehabilitation with no resources to do so. But we have seen an increase in violent crimes, certainly. When I say violent crimes, I mean what's defined as serious and violent crimes in the penal code. So they're conduct that most people would consider violent and unwanted. And, of course, our retail establishments are feeling the effects at this point of just an increase. I mean, people walking out with 48-inch TVs because they're under $950, and it's a misdemeanor, and they still end up with TVs.
Yeah.
So it's a cost-benefit analysis for them. But certainly I think it's a misnomer to say crime rates are down. If they're down, it's because we've decriminalized a whole lot of conduct, and it's conduct that we prefer not to see in our society. But now that it's legal, we're seeing it more and more.
Yeah, there's statistics. It's certainly true that statistics can be manipulated, but overall, statewide, we would generally see what the PPIC had mentioned in the earlier segment, that overall, statewide, they're generally down. Though, you know, again, there's an uptick recently. So I want to see what's going on in Madera County. So, Sheriff Varney, what's happening in Madera County?
So I don't think the perception really matches the reality in this case. The 14-year decline in crime in California kind of ended in 2014, and we know what got voted in 2014, and that was Proposition 47. And that, as District Attorney Fagundes had just mentioned, de-escalated a number of things from being felonies into being misdemeanors, and has not had an overall positive effect, at least over the first statistical year that I have about the bottom line data for. So in Madera County, and this includes all of our jurisdictions, so this is data that you can look up yourself on the FBI UCR website. We have kind of a mixed bag. So, you know, overall, we've had some things like murders and rapes are either down or stagnant, meaning they didn't go up or down. Aggravated assaults and burglaries are down, but robberies are actually up in our three jurisdictions, Madera County, Madera City, and Chowchilla City, all put together, 25%. And overall property crime is up significantly. It's up 9.5%. And, you know, frankly, I will say from observation that this is a direct result of folks who previously had consequences under the law do not have consequences now under Prop 47.
Yeah, and one of the reasons that was done was because of the overcrowding in the prisons, and so Jerry Brown decided, okay, the way we deal with that is take people out of state prison, put them into county jail, or kind of, I don't know, decriminalize, but taking some of these so-called non-serious, non-violent crimes and putting them in county jails, but there have been repercussions, obviously. And you do see that about the increase in property crimes, but I wonder, Chief Dyer, what about the city of Fresno? Are you seeing the same thing?
Well, we experienced declines in violent crime 2011, 12, 13, and 14. Violent crime was down during those years 4%, 6%, and then back-to-back years is 7%. And unfortunately, in 2015, there was a significant reversal in that trend where violent crime climbed by 15%. And then in addition to that, in 2016, we saw violent crime rise by 11%.
Wow.
And, you know, there's a lot of factors involved in that. I believe that certainly when you have 50,000 fewer people in your California prison system and they're out back in your community, the downsizing of police departments were still reduced in terms of resources by about 80 officers from where we were 8 years ago. So a combination of those things, and I think what we know in our community is that what drives fear is generally things that are publicized in the media or social media in terms of crimes. But the reality is crime is back on the rise throughout Fresno, and I believe throughout the state of California, although we've seen some recent reductions in certain types of categories.
Right. I mean, I think the statistics would bear that out. It's just that what they say, but you have to look at it from historical levels. We're still at low historical levels, though it's trending upward. But Chief Dyer, I want to ask you about this last November election, and specifically Prop 64, legalizing the recreational use of marijuana. What do you think impact it's going to have locally?
Well, I think we're going to see some long-term impacts from people that are using marijuana, I definitely know we're going to see, even though the marijuana law only applies to those individuals that are 21 years of age or older in terms of making it legal, I think the overall message that is sent is that marijuana is not that bad for you, and you'll see an increased usage in kids that are in high school and middle school and hopefully not, but probably elementary school. And that's the case that has occurred in Colorado. And so I think the long-term effect is going to be very impactful in terms of kids that have lost their motivation. We do know that there's a lot of other things that happen with that chemical imbalance, especially with our youth when they're using marijuana. And we won't know what that impact is. I believe without a doubt, consistent with other states who legalize marijuana, that we're going to see an increased level of drugged drivers on our roadways.
Yeah, that's a big issue. Because do you have – I'm sorry for interrupting, Chief, but do you have a set intoxication level for marijuana like you have with alcohol? Is there a figure that they use?
There's not one established in the state of California for THC content. And so what we have to do is establish that person – we reasonably believe that person's under the influence of a drug, which could be marijuana.
Are you doing on observation, right?
Yes, objective symptoms.
Right. And so it looks like are their eyes dilated or is there speech slurred and those kinds of things, I assume.
Yeah, and we also have to show impairment. We have to demonstrate that they were driving in a way that it was obvious that their driving was impaired.
And I assume
so combination
that,
of those.
I assume that when officers have cameras that they can then document, you know, the fact that this person's impaired.
Yeah, all of our officers in the field have body-worn cameras. They activate those when they're going to make a traffic stop. They can hopefully over that video show the impairment in terms of driving. And then also once they make contact with the individual to show that that person is impaired as well.
Right. I'm going to ask the DA here on the panel, DA Fagundes, what you think about this. Is it difficult for you to prosecute these marijuana cases because you don't have that objective number, like an alcohol case?
It's always been significantly more difficult whenever you deal with a controlled substance impairment that is not alcohol, because alcohol has correlation studies that have gone along now for many, many years. Because marijuana is an illegal substance federally, and because it's been illegal for recreation in California for too many years, there's no correlation studies that have ever been done by anybody with any credence to give us that benchmark. So we always look at, and we always have looked at, the objective symptoms, the driving pattern, and the degree of impairment based upon such conduct.
Yeah, so I'm guessing, though, it's going to be I'm guessing it's going to be, you know, as a lawyer myself, I'm guessing that's going to be a little more difficult to prove than when you have that objective number, you know, within alcohol cases. So let me kind of transfer a little bit to another issue with Professor Hughes here about one of the big issues on the November ballot was Prop 57. This is kind of a continuation of this criminal justice reform by the governor. And this initiative would allow for early release of prison inmates convicted of specific nonviolent crimes. Do you think the savings in incarceration costs outweigh the cost of any additional crime that may occur?
Well, I mean, the thing is, obviously, it's going to be a while before we have the data to effectively answer the question. But, you know, there were reasons to believe that this can be very effective because people won't be released early automatically. They will be screened first. And the proposition sets up an incentive for people to take part in rehabilitation programs in prisons. And we know that those programs, when they're run effectively, particularly education programs, can reduce reoffending. And then when everyone is released, they will be supervised in the community by a probation officer or a parole agent. So they won't be, you know, without any oversight at all. So if it's done effectively, and if people really are able to engage in rehabilitation programs, ultimately it could reduce reoffending and also save money. So it could, you know, achieve both goals.
Sheriff Varney, what do you think of that?
Well, I think you have to look at who's going to actually garner the savings in this. And now the monetary end, the state's certainly going to save a significant amount of money. If they do like they did with AB 109, they will not pass that entire savings down to the local communities to engage in the supervision that Dr. Hughes mentioned. However, they will pass down some of the money. But
by the way, Sheriff, that has been a big concern by local communities. They're saying, yeah, you're shifting this cost from state prisons to county jails, but not a correlation in terms of the money that it's going to cost for us to do this job. That's what I'm hearing.
Yeah, so when they did AB 109, they gave us about 50% of the money, and I think most of your Central Valley counties did an outstanding job of adapting to that very significant change in how we did business. However, when you throw in 47, that's actually taken away some of the incentives for some of the treatment programs that were successful in a custody setting. And now you're going to have 2,000 more offenders this year come back into the community. So the bottom line is that I think that you're looking at the crime victims, the local communities, and the public safety agencies are going to bear the cost of the new crimes committed by the early release individuals. However, on a person-to-person basis, this will be successful for some offenders, and it's going to be a disaster for others.
Yeah, yeah. Professor Hughes, let me ask you another question. You know, it seems like in the 1990s, there was a focus on this kind of tough-on-crime approach, you know, three strikes, determinant sentencing, regardless of cost. It was just, you know, tough-on-crime. Now the focus seems to be changed a little bit to more of a focus on rehabilitation over incarceration. You know, you could talk about realignment in 2011, or how three strikes was amended in 2012, or how they reduced certain drug felonies to misdemeanors in 2014, or then last year's proposition that made nonviolent felons considered for early release, we were just talking about. What do you think about this rebalancing? Was it necessary, or have we gone too far?
Well, in general, I would say the rebalancing was necessary. We had gone to an absolute extreme before. Our prison population had just mushroomed over the period of the 80s and the 90s, at great cost, of course, at great financial cost. But also, it wasn't effective in terms of reducing returns to prison. So before realignment, you know, 70% of people released from prison within 2 years were back inside again for parole violations or for new crimes. So it wasn't like there was a total reduction in reoffending. And, you know, I completely agree with early comments that, you know, we have to properly resource the rehabilitation programs and community supervision and things like that. If we don't put the money into those programs at the county level, then it's not going to be effective. But if we do have well-designed, well-targeted programs, whether in prisons or jails or in community settings, the evidence shows that they can absolutely reduce reoffending. And, of course, if they're done in the community, it's also a cost benefit to everyone as well.
Yeah, Chief Dyer, let me get your input on this. Has the pendulum gone too far in terms of rehabilitation over incarceration?
Well, I think the pendulum's has swung very fast and too far and has already stayed too long. And I think the answer is absolutely true that in the 90s there was an over-reliance on incarceration versus punishment. But I don't believe it needs to be either or. It isn't either punishment or rehabilitation. It is both. And we know that in order for rehabilitation to work, for treatment programs to work, there have to be consequences for those individuals that fail to comply with treatment or walk away from programs. We don't have that today. And so what we do know is that the savings that we have seen as a result of this renewed focus on rehabilitation has been at the state level only through the downsizing of the prison population and has not transferred over to local governments to where the resources are there now to truly rehabilitate. The treatment programs are not there. And the ones that are there, people aren't taking advantage of them because there's no consequences if they don't.
Yeah.
So you've got to have both punishment and rehabilitation.
Yeah, the pendulum swings, you know, both ways. Hopefully we get it to the center. I want to ask, we've only got about a minute or so left, but I wanted to ask the Kings County DA Fagundes about this new move, an attempt at criminal justice reform in the state capitol. They're talking about reforming the state's bail system. And the argument is that the current bail system is unfair because it penalizes the poor, resulting in a situation where they either have to go into debt to pay bail bonds company, or they just plead guilty to a crime that they didn't commit just to get through the system faster. I mean, do you think the bail bond system needs an overhaul?
You know, they have overhauled it nearly every year as they keep lowering bail in any regard. So most jails don't keep individuals with $15,000 or less bail on them. And so most people are having turnaround trips at the jail anyway, especially the most indigent individuals. They are turned around. Now, if you have a serious or violent crime where bail is in the hundreds of thousands or so, or a murder where it's no bail at all, then, of course, people are going to stay in. And that's what it's designed to do. But I don't know that, you know, to echo Chief Dyer, I think the pendulum is swinging way too fast and way too far, in that the same programs that have existed and that they're proposing now to rehabilitate have been in existence in the state prison They just haven't availed themselves, the inmates, that is, of the opportunity to do some rehabilitation. And so, you know, they changed the name to CDCR, putting the R at the end for rehabilitation in the 80s was to emphasize rehabilitation. And all their efforts have failed because they failed to build newer and more adequate facilities to keep up with the growing population. We ended up with a slight overcrowding argument, but you can come to our three prisons in our Kings County, and they're a ghost town down there. There's a lot of room in those prisons.
Well, so, I do want to get in, Professor Hughes. I'm sorry, I apologize for interrupting, but we've only got about 30 seconds. Actually, we're over in this segment, but I did want to get Professor Hughes one last word, quick 30 seconds. What do you think about the bail bond system? Does it need reform?
Well, the main thing we have to make sure is we don't have a two-tier system whereby those who aren't able to afford bail are held in custody and with great disruption to family, accommodation, employment, if they do have that. So it's just to make sure that there is not a different system for those who don't have the money.
Okay, well, more on crime and punishment in a moment. This is the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition.
You're listening to the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition on KMJ.
Welcome back. We're talking about public safety in the Valley with Madera County Sheriff Jay Varney, Kings County District Attorney Keith Fagundes, Fresno Chief of Police Jerry Dyer, and Cal State University Fresno Criminology Professor Emma Hughes. So I want to turn to Madera County Sheriff Varney about and talk to him about police staffing levels. Hit pretty hard during the recession. Have your local staffing levels recovered?
No, they have not. We've tried to do as much as we can in civilianized positions that don't absolutely have to be a sworn position, but we're still staffed at a level below where we were staffed 10 years ago in the area of 5 or 10% below what we used to have.
Chief Dyer, same thing in the city of Fresno. Are you below your pre-recession staffing levels?
Yeah, we're significantly below. We lost about 20% of our police officers during the recession and about 60% of our civilians. We are now down about 10% on officers, which is about 80 police officers where we were in 2008. And we're down 160 of our civilians, dispatchers, crime scene investigators, which is still 40% below where we were. And the problem is over that 8 years, our workload and calls for service demand have increased, so that which makes us even further behind.
Yeah. So I want to ask Sheriff Varney, I know you guys up in Madera County are considering something called Measure L. And I wonder if you could tell us a little about what Measure L is and why do you think you need it?
Sure, Mark. I'd love to tell you a little bit about that. So Measure L is a March 7th ballot initiative. It's a sales tax increment. It is on the ballot to approve or disapprove a 1% increase in the sales tax for Madera County residents to support primarily improved fire staffing and fire stationing, meaning that there will be fire stations, fire equipment, and fire personnel will dominate the money that's spent here. However, 20% of the funding will come to the Madera County Sheriff's Office specifically for new patrol deputies and other positions, but all for sworn positions. So in the initial mix, we would get 7 new deputy positions by the time of final build-out, which we think is in about the 4th or 5th year of the measure if it's passed. We'll have 9 additional deputies. We think this is a good move in terms of if we're going to ask the public to approve a tax, Madera County is primarily funded in certain areas by recreational visitors, and they can help us provide the services they enjoy while they're in our county without burdening the citizens with the entire bill of services.
You know, it's interesting that it's kind of a pay me now or pay me later kind of situation when it comes to a lot of public policy issues, and crime is certainly one of those. Research shows that, you know, hiring more officers is a very cost-effective way to address crime. Now, the fact is that a single officer typically costs, what, about $100,000 if you add salary and benefits, health insurance and pensions. So there is a limit to what the public can afford. But when you're talking about Measure L and adding more staff, from the research I've seen, adding more police officers is a pretty cost-effective way to deal with that. But, you know, let's assume for sake of argument that, you know, funds are not unlimited. So what I'd like to ask you, start with Sheriff Varney, is what are the cost-effective ways are you looking at providing police protection in Madera County?
So where we are kind of focusing our attention is in two areas. One is in supporting our partner providers who do early childhood education. We support programs like First Five, Fight Crime Investing Kids, Teach One to Lead One, and Big Brothers and Big Sisters, all of whom are involved in either direct teaching or mentoring the folks who are going to be at risk to join the future, I don't know, I guess we'll call it input, folks into the criminal justice system. We want them to have successful lives, so we're doing everything we can to partner with those folks to demonstrate that being an active and involved citizen as an adult is a good thing for them to shoot for as far as goals. The other thing we're doing is we've been starting a pilot program. Certainly, Jerry is way beyond us there in Fresno in terms of using cameras from folks that already have them on their private property and granting, in our case, the sheriff's office the ability to access those through the Internet if they desire, so that when we're responding to crimes in their area or crimes on their specific property, we have more input and can therefore deploy the resources we already have and already pay for in a more cost-effective manner.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So, Chief Dyer, since you were mentioned, what are you doing in the city of Fresno to become more cost-effective? Are you using drones, for example?
No, we are not taking advantage of drones yet, but number one is we take advantage of whatever technology is out there. We have a system called PredPol, which is predictive analytics. It designates where our officers should be spending their time in order to prevent or deter crime based on crime that has occurred over the past 5 years, and it's done through an algorithm.
So you're specifically targeting an area, saying it at 5 o'clock on a Saturday, this is a problem area. Is that what you're doing?
We don't get into the hour, but by shift.
Okay.
So day shift, swing shift, midnights, they each have designated boxes that they are told this is where crime is most likely to occur. And by you being present there, you can deter certain types of criminal activity, whichever one you may be focused on. Gun violence, burglaries, whatever the case is. So that's one piece of technology. We also have video policing cameras throughout our city that we monitor in our real-time crime center 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We have gunshot detection in 6 square miles of our city through a system called ShotSpotter, where once a gunshot occurs, shooting occurs, it's automatically conveyed to our patrol car. There's a icon they can click on and see within a few feet of where that gunshot occurred within about 20 to 30 seconds. And we also are taking advantage of our officers in our schools. We have an officer on every middle school campus called Student and Neighborhood Resource Officers. We have officers on all of our high school campuses called Student Resource Officers, chaplains in 25 of our elementary schools teaching what's called resilience and student education. So we're trying to reach the future, because I think in years past, we've lost somewhat of a generation. And so we're trying to be balanced in that approach in not only our enforcement efforts, taking advantage of technology, but also our intervention and prevention efforts.
Yeah, I want to ask Kings County DA Fagundes about Kings County. It's a little more rural than Fresno, city of Fresno, certainly. What are you doing to be more cost-effective in the use of your police officers and sheriffs in Kings County?
Well, as you know, I'm the chief law enforcement officer, but I don't run each department. We have 6 different local agencies. I coordinate with the sheriffs and their commanders. And, you know, as far as being cost-effective, I can only look at prosecution. And I really hate to speak for what they're doing day to day, but I do know that Hanford PD has looked at, and we are participating with their restorative justice process. Mm-hmm. We started off with juveniles so that we divert them out of the system before they ever get in the system for a lot of the crimes that we can get restitution for victims and get these kids back on the right path. The sheriff, of course, Dave Robinson, is phenomenal for our county. He's involved in every agency, and he takes advantage of any assistance and any money we can get from Sacramento to implement new projects, and he's been very successful at that. But I really hate to speak for each agency other than that we participate and cooperate. I think the restorative justice is probably was our first step into doing low-cost measures to divert crime and to really help kids.
Now, you know, I want to give you all very quickly the police officers and the DA a chance to inform the public. What can we do to help, you know, reduce crime in our community? So quickly, let's start with Chief Dyer.
Well, I think being a good witness, number one, being involved in neighborhood watch within your neighborhood, or the Next Door program, which is a social media neighborhood watch, and also making sure that you're not being easily targeted as a victim, taking your valuables out of your car,
at home, making sure your doors are locked, the windows are secure, have an alarm system. Those things are going to be what we call target hardening. That
you know, I have to tell you, Chief, you sound like my wife. You know, I grew up in a rural area on the East Coast, and we never locked our doors. And I'm still living that way. My wife is telling me exactly what you're saying. So, so I just want to let you know, I'm getting it not just over on the radio here, but also at home. But let me ask Sheriff Varney, what can the public do to help you do your job better?
Well, one of the things is don't take the burden onto yourself of combating crime, meaning if something gets stolen from your property, we want to know. Even if we have to take the report by phone, if we don't know that you're being victimized, then we don't know how to redeploy our resources. And the other thing is what Jerry mentioned here, the better crime prevention you can do for your own property, your own vehicle, your own personal safety, the more likely that you'll be safe and the suspects will move on to another area of the state.
All very, very good advice. I'm so sorry we're out of time. We could talk for hours on this topic. I want to thank Madera County Sheriff Jay Varney, Kings County District Attorney Keith Fagundes, Jerry Dyer, the Fresno City Chief of Police, Cal State University Fresno Criminology Professor Emma Hughes, as well as Magnus Lofstrom and Brandon Martin from the Public Policy Institute of California. Thanks, all of you, for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
The views and opinions expressed on the Matter Report are those of the individuals participating in the program and do not necessarily reflect those of the California Channel or the Matter Institute. If you'd like to share your thoughts about the points and opinions expressed on the Matter Report, visit our website at matterinstitute.org.
The Matty Report, Valley Views Edition, is a public affairs partnership between KMJ Radio, Cumulus Media, and the nonpartisan Matty Institute, providing the Valley with valuable insight and analysis on politics and important public policy issues. This is KMJ.